Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hey everyone, this is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. Recently, I spoke with physician and philosopher of medicine, Hillel Broad, about his 2012 book, Intuition in Medicine, A Philosophical Defense of Clinical Reasoning. Hillel currently works at the Mifne Center in northern Israel, where he researches autism. In this book, which grew out of his PhD thesis, Broad scrutinizes the category of clinical reason, posited in various forms throughout the history of medical thought. He argues that a re-emphasis on the notion of intuition can bridge the gap he identifies between medical and moral reasoning. Rather than setting out to formally define intuition, he focuses on where it crops up in different contexts and debates. The result is a satisfying, well-argued tour through the history of medical thought, from the Hippocratics through the evidence-based medicine movement. Of the many stops on this tour, we find a section analyzing the relationship between theoretical and practical reasoning in the work of Aristotle, chapters addressing the consequences of statistics on medical thinking, and discussions throughout of where and how insights from phenomenology can give ethics a better understanding of the human subject. Importantly, Broad argues that uncertainty is intrinsic to clinical reasoning as a human process, and it's a category error, really, to simply say that more data will necessarily produce better decisions. In practice, intuition bridges moral and scientific judgments as they are commingled with human perception. It therefore warrants deeper consideration by both philosophers and physicians. On the author's suggestions and my optimistic reading, intuition seems a topic ripe for lively discussion and collaboration between the two professions. This is certainly a challenging read for the breadth and depth of the philosophical approaches discussed, but it invites and caters well to a broad range of interests, philosophy, specifically ethics and phenomenology, medical and bioethics, as well as history and sociology of science. It was really great to hear Hillel explain his thinking more deeply, and I hope our discussion will provide food for thought for those interested. Hi, everyone. This is Mikey McGovern. I'm speaking today with Hillel Broad. Hillel, welcome to New Books in Medicine.
Hi, Mikey. Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss my book, Intuition in Medicine, with you. Really looking forward to our discussion.
Great. All right, so I guess let's get going. Yeah, so I'm just going to, you know, basically kind of walk through the book. And, well, have you walk us through the book, me talking as little as possible. and basically just, you know, try to see what salient points emerge from the discussion.
Okay. Cool. This is quite a task in a way. I was just reading through the book today just before the meeting and realized what a scope it what a long trajectory in the book. I don't know what it was like for you to read it or to review it, but as the title of the book is, it's Intuition in Medicine, a Philosophical Defense of Clinical Reasoning. And it's an attempt on my part, as having a background as a medical doctor and then acquiring the tools of philosophy, to provide some kind of philosophical reflection on clinical reasoning and the processes of clinical reasoning. And intuition was a means for me of getting into the heart of what I thought clinical reasoning is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say in the introduction, that I don't really refer to one specific definition of clinical reasoning, because what I discovered when I was conducting my research was that a lot of the confusion that arises around talking about intuition in medicine is that people are actually using different definitions of intuition without acknowledging it. And so it leads to a lot of confusion. One of the main insights I had was that there were two broad uses of intuition. One is a philosophical sense of intuition, as a kind of absolute certainty or incorrigible certainty, going back all the way to the beginning of the history of philosophy, and certainly continuing into the modern period. And then intuition, as most people think about it, as a kind of a common sense, as a kind of a gut sense, and which is often the way it's used by clinicians in terms of relating to clinical reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the exploration of the book was to explore how these two very different definitions of intuition are interrelate in terms of clinical practice. And the scope of the book is quite large, moving from ancient philosophy and medicine to modern day 20th century, 21st century definitions of medicine and clinical reasoning. And having a background as a clinician, I found in my own experience in terms of medical ethics and in terms of philosophy, that there was a real problem that I felt was that I needed to address, in the sense that physicians don't really have the philosophical language to analyze what it is they actually do. And so a lot of the terrain was being left to people who didn't really have exposure to or clinical experience. And so in my opinion, we're presenting in their own way a kind of a biased understanding of clinical medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And intuition for me was a way of really getting to the heart of what clinical reasoning was about. So the different chapters, there's eight different chapters in the book. The first chapter is a general overview of the concept of intuition in medical and moral reasoning, and where I analyze the debate or attention that played out in the development of bioethics in the 1970s and 80s between physicians and philosophers over the scope and nature of medical ethics. And what I found really interesting was that how this was paralleled in the attitudes towards intuition in medicine, and even the use of intuition in philosophical arguments. And my approach is, which I, at the time I thought was somewhat unique was to look at bioethics through firmly in terms of history and philosophy of science.
Mm-hmm.
So the book is pretty philosophical, quite dense. And
you also do maintain that kind of, you know, there's a very strong historical sense that pervades the work that I think unifies a lot of what you're saying in a way. And you're right, that, I mean, when I was looking for books to interview people on, this one really struck me because of the way that it united the historical and philosophical sides of things. Because I'm someone who tends to interview historians of medicine, but I wanted to, you know, bring someone into the network who had more of a philosophical inclination. But on that note also, I think that one of the things that I found was interesting, and I guess this is two questions in this. One is more about your background, but two, I sort of found that the focus on, you know, certain guiding texts and trying to historically contextualize them really kind of bears the mark of your PhD program, which was in the Committee on Social Thought or something related to that at the University of Chicago, if I'm correct?
Right. It was one of the interdisciplinary committees at the University of Chicago. It wasn't the Committee of Social Thought, which is the most famous interdisciplinary committee, but a committee called Committee for the History of Culture, which at the time was setting up a program in medicine and culture.
Okay, I see. And so what led you in the first place, you know, from being a physician to head off to the University of Chicago to the PhD in History and Culture?
Right, that's a great question. Well, I mean, the most compelling thing was my own curiosity and desire to continue my own learning process. As my background was as a coming out, as growing up in South Africa, and being trained as a doctor in South Africa, and in distinction to studying medicine in the United States, where one. First of all, you have to do a pre-med program where you get hopefully some kind of broader grounding, and then you start medicine. In South Africa, the medical system is modeled on the British system, where one goes into medicine straight after school. And well, I've always been interested in the humanities and philosophy, and I was perhaps a little bit naive, but I thought that my medical education would be, at least in part, if not in whole, a humanistic education.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered was that one can, and I think the situation is still like this today, although it's probably better in medical schools that emphasize a humanities component, for example, narrative medicine. But what I discovered was that you could go through your whole medical training learning about the how of disease and the what of disease, but never really grappling with the why of disease and the why of medicine. And for me, that was something which I felt I needed to address. But I also needed to address it because training and working in South Africa, which was an incredible experience for a clinician, but was also full of quite traumatic experiences in terms of dealing with the social effects of apartheid on people's bodies and the culture in the medical school. And what I realized, though, was that what I saw as a certain dehumanism within the medical system wasn't simply a result of the particular South African context, but I thought was part of a deeper crisis within medicine, which I thought needed to be addressed, looking at the epistemology of medicine, how medicine constructs its objects and its subjects, and that really was the overarching. Motivation, in a sense, compelling me to understand, to undertake this project, to try and really grapple with what medicine is about and what it could be, and again, intuition became a kind of a central prism or focus in which to go into this question, because I thought, for example, I was reading a wonderful people like Edmund Pellegrino and Eric Cassell, who were real pioneers in terms of medical humanities. But at the same time, once I became really familiar with their work, I had the sense that it wasn't sufficient simply to incorporate some kind of humanistic training within the medical curriculum, but actually there was something within the epistemology of medicine which itself deserved a fuller critique. So those are some of my, you know, some of my background motivations for writing the book and doing the dissertation. And then I was offered a kind of a scholarship to do a PhD in this medical humanities program. So that was how I got to Chicago. But there were reasons also compelling me to go to the University of Chicago. For example, Professor Leon Cass was teaching on the Committee of Social Thought, and I was interested in his work and the legacy of Hans Jonas, which was a very influential figure for Cass and for Kassel and for others.
And sort of and serves as a strong kind of background figure, I think, in your book quite a bit.
Yeah, Hans Jonas was really, really important for my thinking, and he appears. He appears in the book, critiquing kind of issues of brain death and reflecting on brain death and issues of temporality in medicine and issue of correlation in medicine. Hans Jonas was really important for the development of my thinking.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So we were discussing the first chapter, and I kind of want to dial back a bit to the introduction and the way that you frame the book, just to give our listeners some of a kind of way into the approach you take. And so you begin with the classic Aristotelian syllogism: all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. And you do this to draw attention to the fact that what mortality consists in often seems to go unquestioned, right? And then you claim that medicine, in a way, has helped philosophy advance beyond these abstracted conceptions of universal reason. And could you maybe develop this a bit more for us? Like, you know, what does medicine actually give philosophy? You know, sort of you going from a medical program to a philosophy and history PhD. And I think you're in a unique position to reflect on this.
Right. Okay. Thanks. That's also kind of a great question. You know, what I kind of detail, I think it's in that first chapter, is that if one looks at the very first development of Western medicine from Hippocratic medicine, there's a really strong philosophical influence on medicine, and it's a debate amongst classicists whether medicine influences philosophy or philosophy influences medicine, but what seems really clear is that once one is talking about Western medicine, one is talking about a certain process of abstraction. Which is ultimately completely reliant on philosophy and philosophical reflection, and sorry, someone was there. And this process of abstraction, so it's completely fundamental for the development of Western medicine, but at the same time, this process of abstraction means abstracting from real fleshly humans and the interaction between humans. So this process of abstraction, which is on the one hand necessary for the development of medicine and necessary for the movement of medicine away from magic, at the same time, it then becomes historically associated with a process of dehumanization. So it's a dialectic between what is necessary to found a scientific method and questioning what are the limits of that process of scientific abstraction. And again, one way of thinking about the book is exploring or fleshing out this process. And Aristotle still is, but is a central figure in terms of this process because of his notion of practical wisdom and his key insight that different forms of problems or questions or require different methods. And so what is a good method for a mathematician is not necessarily a good method for a navigator or for a physician. And this insight is key also in the contemporary attempts to model clinical reasoning on Aristotelian practical wisdom. In terms of what medicine gives philosophy, so Stephen Toulmin, who also was for many years a professor at the University of Chicago, he also had this key insight that described as medicine giving relevance to philosophy. Mm-hmm. He thought that particularly in terms of analytic philosophy, so Stephen Toulmin wrote this classical article on, let me see if I can just find the title, How Medicine Saved the Life of Ethics, where he basically argues that casuistry or case-based reasoning restores a relevance to analytic philosophy, which had become very dry and detached from reality. Incidentally, Stephen Toulmin was also very involved in the MacLean Center for Clinical Ethics, where I was also doing a fellowship at the time while I was at the University of Chicago. And this field of clinical medical ethics is also something quite central in terms of reviving case-based reasoning. Mm-hmm. But for Toulmin, the method of casuistry or case-based reasoning provided a real opportunity for medicine for philosophy to rediscover its relevance in relation to real life. And for a lot of analytic philosophers, medical ethics as a form of applied ethics doesn't really have that much seriousness, because what's often is considered really serious philosophy is, again, this process of abstraction. Mm-hmm. What is considered to be the most rational. And again, going back to Aristotle, for Aristotle's notion of practical wisdom says really disputes that and says really what's important is the problem at hand. And if it's a practical problem, you need practical wisdom. And to try and to find theoretical answers to practical problems is the very least it's a category error. But mm-hmm. Aristotle implies that it's actually less rational. So yeah, I hope that kind of answers or provides some kind of introduction to your question. But I can obviously expand on that.
Oh no, absolutely. I think that it's similar to how Aristotle suggested that particular approaches are needed for certain kinds of knowledge. I think that it's interesting how your approach to the concept of intuition is very, very different than other sort of more formalized analytic frameworks would handle it. And your choice specifically not to really define definition, but to kind of see where it crops up in different discourses is kind of, uniquely suited to the task at hand. And I congratulate you on that. And it makes it a really fascinating book, tying in all these diverse threads of thought about medicine.
Mm. Well, thanks very much.
So we already sort of talked a little bit about chapter one and sort of the history of intuition as it's used in medical ethics. But in chapter two, you address, sort of the rise of moral intuitionism in thinking about medicine, which is kind of, you define as a non-naturalistic approach to thinking about morals, where the good isn't taken to be a really attainable thing on the basis of our existence as humans, but is just something mm-hmm. that we create. However, you argue that nonetheless, this approach, while kind of denying this sort of naturalizing essential claim to there being one human good, you say that it still neglects temporal and narrative aspects of patients' lives. Would you be willing to expand on that a bit?
Right. So the non-natural approach ignores the temporal aspects. Right. It presents a kind of the monster I'm fighting in the book to some extent is this process of abstraction, then you find it in various philosophical approaches. But in terms of non-naturalism, following on from G. E. Moore, this notion that of this absolute dichotomy between facts and values. Mm-hmm. And temporality would be a kind of, as I argue at the end of the chapter, where a prevalent view in philosophy is that time has absolutely no moral weight in terms of reasoning about the good end for patients, is precisely coming out of this notion that there's no relationship between is and ought, and between facts and values, as the non-naturalists claim. However, this flies in the face of most clinicians, although it's changing somewhat as moral values perhaps of physicians change. But traditionally, there's a strong sense that temporality or time is of real importance in terms of clinical reasoning and in terms of moral reflection on what constitutes a good action for a patient, or and yet, according to the non-naturalist perspective, temporality would have really nothing to say in terms of moral reasoning. And for example, in terms of, as I write about at the end of the chapter, in terms of proximity to death, for most clinicians, whether a patient is close to death or not close to death is of great importance in helping to decide what are the treatment options in terms of, particularly in terms of issues of the doctrine of double effect and providing adequate analgesia. So that kind of intuition that physicians have, that proximity to death is of great moral importance, but at the same time would conflate facts and values for a lot of abstract philosophers, particularly the non-naturalists. It doesn't have any validity. And yet, if it has validity for clinicians, what I wanted to say was that this doesn't mean that one should dismiss it, because one can't provide the philosophical grounds in which to prove why it should have value. Rather than simply dismissing it, what I wanted to argue was that it itself has. The fact that physicians have these very strong intuitions means that one has to try and figure out why they have these strong intuitions, and without simply dismissing it, because it's hard to find the foundations, particularly based on a particularly a theoretical approach. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes back to practical wisdom and the need to ground one's evidence and one's arguments in relation to concrete reality and to lived experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, and it's through that you kind of return to the next section of the book, which deals with sort of your reading of Aristotle and how it relates to how he's sort of been cast in previous accounts, particularly on the nature of practical wisdom, but also, you know, you trying to, you know, flesh out some strand of intuition, which I think that it's that sense of understanding or nous that you sort of try to look at the relationship between, you know, how does practical wisdom relate actually to some kind of understanding? And so where does your, this is kind of a loaded question, but where does your interpretation of Aristotle begin to depart from some of those of your predecessors, such as Pellegrino and Tomasoma, mm-hmm. who you talk about quite a bit?
Right. So, first of all, I should say I'm a big fan of Edmund Pellegrino and David Tomasma's work. At the same time, I found myself taking quite a strongly critical position of particularly Pellegrino's conception of practical wisdom, and in particular the absolute non-validity that Pellegrino gave to the place of intuition in clinical reasoning. So Pellegrino and Tomasma were certainly pioneers in terms of writing about medicine in terms of virtue ethics, mm-hmm. and particularly the central concept in virtue ethics in terms of practical wisdom or phronesis as the one virtue that links up the intellectual and the emotional virtues in medicine and provides the means of thinking both about the means of an action and the end of an action, of a clinical action. Mm-hmm. But what I found, again, when I started reading Pellegrino closely, was that he really was modeling his notion of medical science on what was really and essentially a 17th century notion of science. Mm-hmm. And it's that same 17th century notion of science which doesn't really have any place for intuition. Out of this desire to really found a science on the foundations of epistemological certainty, but in relation to medicine, I found that this was a really a big problem or a big gap or a poria in Pellegrino's writing. And from my own reading of Aristotle, first of all, it became obvious that the relationship of nous to phronesis is not straightforward. And certainly according to one reading, which was a reading that for obvious reasons I was attracted to espouse, is to say that phronesis itself contains the possibility or the necessity to be founded on an intuitive basis, even though it's dealing with what is essentially variable and uncertain. Mm-hmm. But Pellegrino, basically, he associates intuition with art, which for Aristotle is translated as techne. And so Pellegrino wants to say, yes, there is a certain techne within medicine, but he doesn't want to associate medicine with anything to do with art, because then in his mind it starts being associated with things like magic and what is essentially unscientific. But what I came to the conclusion or realization when I was doing this research is that medicine is essentially deals with what is uncertain and what is variable. And so in order to ground medicine on as most scientific foundations as possible, and on a medicine which is describing really what it's dealing with in terms of human variability, then you can't get away from the uncertainty. And on the one hand, this is what Aristotle was talking about in relation to phronesis, but on the other hand, it also really makes sense when you incorporate intuition within the conception of phronesis. And this is because when one is talking about clinical reasoning, it's, in my opinion, it's very, very important to acknowledge the role of tacit knowing in clinical reasoning. So, and nous for me was the Aristotelian conception which tied up sort of ancient philosophical thinking and modern thinking about tacit knowing in medicine. And again, Pellegrino, he didn't see this sufficiently or at all in his own writings on practical wisdom and practical reasoning in medicine.
Mm-hmm. And going back to what you were saying about kind of viewing medicine as akin to 17th century science, one of the other really interesting moves that you make in this book is you sort of compare the rise or the modernization of medicine to the rise of another discipline that attempted to deal with uncertainty, you know, both of which, you know, very, very recent. You looked at statistics. And so I think this is in your fifth chapter. You talked mm-hmm. about the relationship between phronesis and physiognomy, right?
Right.
And how these sort of both feed into our modern logics and cosmologies of medicine, which are in a way shared with those of early statistics, at least.
Right, and again, and also it links up with intuition. So as I write in the introduction, that intuition is very important because it provides a kind of a moral image of human beings that is really important for philosophy. And it's this image of the human associated with intuition as a kind of anthropomorphism, which also is really critiqued in terms of modern philosophy. But in my mind, this human image is really important in terms of medicine and medical ethics, and it's that image which links up with physiognomy. So it wasn't that I was so much looking to justify physiognomy, which in and of itself is a rather dubious scientific enterprise. But if you look at the history of the development of statistics, you see how central physiognomy was for the development of modern statistics. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to show was that central physiognomy was for the development of modern statistics. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to show was that this image, this human image, which you find within, first of all, individual physiognomy, and then moving to statistical physiognomy, is still somehow embedded within these supposedly abstract processes of statistical inferences and correlations.
Right.
And what happens is that once this particular statistical technique or methodology has been established, then the processes in which these methodologies were discovered, which in themselves had their own concrete context, then that gets forgotten about and erased, and then the human image which is central for the development of these statistical methodologies, particularly the most important one in terms of regression and correlation, then this image kind of gets forgotten about, and yet when you start rubbing against the grain of this abstraction, you come back to the centrality of the human image. Mm-hmm. And as you might be able to detect, there's an ethical imperative for me lying at the heart of this analysis, which is constantly trying to bring medicine back to the responsibility for the individual or for the individual other. And once that abstraction happens, which is a necessary abstraction for the development of medical knowledge, but once that abstraction becomes rarefied, then it can become dangerous or harmful.
Right. And what you sort of diagnose as the apex of reified abstraction is the sort of movement known as evidence-based medicine, and that's what we deal with in the next chapter. And I was wondering if you could expand on how, in particular, you see evidence-based medicine as encroaching upon clinical reason, and also problematically, like you said, mm-hmm. abstracting away our image of the human being.
Okay, so I should just say that my chapter on evidence-based medicine was really referring to the origins of evidence-based medicine. So I'm not really qualified at this point to say what evidence-based medicine is at this moment and how, because a lot has happened since, certainly since my book has been published and in terms of the people that I was writing about who founded evidence-based medicine. But I would hazard a hunch or guess and say that I would imagine that nothing really has changed since since the book has been published. But I would love to see if that hunch is true or not. Mm-hmm. But because as I kind of write about is that, you know, there's been a huge amount of critiques leveled against evidence-based medicine, and a lot of the critiques stem from from essentially evidence-based medicine's huge success in becoming the mainstream of clinical education. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, evidence-based medicine, at least as it developed in terms of the emphasis on the randomized controlled trial, was essentially the success of evidence-based medicine was achieved at the expense of individual processes of clinical reasoning. And as I detail in the chapter, Dave Sackett, who was then the main force behind evidence-based medicine, he learned most of the tools of his trade in terms of clinical epidemiology from a physician at Yale University, Alvin Feinstein, mm-hmm. who really was the main person who was promoting the intelligent use of statistics in relation to clinical evidence. And yet for Feinstein, the use of statistics should never be at the expense of the particular individual. And what he found and what I saw was that the success of evidence-based medicine is achieved precisely through sacrificing the individual. Mm-hmm. So in the face of the critique of this kind of critique against evidence-based medicine, proponents of evidence-based medicine proposed what they called like an N of one trial, which is basically a trial of just one person. But as far as I could see, they didn't really provide a proper methodology in terms of how to apply evidence, statistical evidence, which is essentially achieved at the level of populations, to the particular individual with whom a particular clinician is interacting. Mm-hmm. So, for example, as I describe at the beginning of the chapter, Sackett used to do ward rounds with a big database, computerized database, where he would, try and pull off the most applicable randomized trials to evidence from randomized trials to the patient in front of him. But that doesn't really get to the heart of what clinical reasoning is about, mm-hmm. which for Feinstein was in terms of determining which particular subgroups a patient fitted into. And, I've recently been reading Eric Assell's latest book on the nature of clinical medicine, where he details really, really nicely the processes of that clinicians or expert clinicians should do in terms of dealing with or reflecting on particular patients and the role of subjectivity, both in terms of patient subjectivity and in terms of physician subjectivity, in terms of achieving the best diagnosis and the best outcomes and the best action. And evidence-based medicine, as far as I understand it, really doesn't touch this in a significant way. And the important point to stress is that I'm certainly not against the use of statistics in medicine and the use of numbers in medicine, which is absolutely crucial. But again, the question is how to do this intelligently in a way in which the patient isn't the abstraction. The focus of attention isn't the abstraction, but the focus is the individual patient. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And you have a lot of, you have a lot of interesting reflections, I think, throughout the remainder of the book on sort of, this deep relationship between, statistics as trying to solve a certain kind of problem at a moment when medicine was also looking to, sort of solve its own sort of disciplinary and epistemic problems. Like in chapter 7, you compare Francis Galton's statistics with a French anatomist Javier Bichat's theory of the correlation between the pathological and the anatomical, which is something that's taken up quite a bit by Georges Canguilhem, who seems to be informing that chapter quite a bit. Right. And I think it's really interesting to sort of, I think, always lay bare these kind of assumptions and disciplinary foundations. And I think that, if anything, the book, rather than being overly critical of these, sort of just reminds us that we need to, consider our epistemological bases But I wanted to, since we're sort of running out of time, I wanted to head to the conclusion of the book, actually, if that would be all right.
And yeah,
because you conclude with this sort of with a plea for phenomenological considerations in medical ethics. And so phenomenological approaches are, while not really, you know, de rigueur, at least not unheard of in medical anthropology. So what would be the difference between, you know, this kind of anthropological work and the work that you're trying to inspire in medical ethics? Is this, you know, simply tantamount to saying that medical ethics should be more anthropological?
Well, okay. I'm just wondering if, you know, maybe if you could rephrase the question a little bit. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, there's a there's a tradition of philosophical anthropology, which is different from social anthropology. So when you're using anthropology, are you talking, which I'm not sure which sense of anthropology you're using. Certainly, my book is an exercise in philosophical anthropology, for sure. So I'm wondering if you're referring to philosophical anthropology.
I would say probably I'm referring to philosophical anthropology. It's just, it's interesting because the, you know, the work is, you know, sort of skirting the boundary between medical ethics in, you know, the fact that you're kind of, your subject matter is the writings of medical ethicists. But it's not specifically cast as kind of a new sort of theoretical approach to medicine. That's in a lot of the way that these more theoretically motivated anthropological works go, they tend to be motivated by, you know, certain sorts of practical engagements and ethnography. Whereas for you, it's this sort of you're sort of taking a stance as someone who's worked as a medical ethicist and as a clinician. And so I think that the stakes of this book seem to be a bit different, which is why I wanted to kind of tease apart the two.
Right. I mean, it's just the certainness of the style in terms of writing the book and writing the dissertation. And certainly my concerns came out of, to some extent or a great extent, out of my own personal experience in terms of as a clinician, in terms of a clinical ethicist. At the same time, I had this deep sense that it was important to mine the epistemological foundations of a lot of the practices and ideas in order to first of all to be able to understand, and secondly to try and change things as the case may be. But certainly the terrain of the book is mostly theoretical. Just a word about phenomenology. So I, you know, the concluding chapter, as you say, is really about phenomenology. And there were a number of reasons for this. First of all was because when I started off initiating my research, I actually thought that I was going to be doing a project in phenomenology. And what I found was that the deeper I went into my research, the more I felt I had to do a lot of clearing in terms of analytic philosophy. But at the same time, there was a real phenomenological motivation behind the book certainly in terms of Husserl's conception of intuition, and particularly the work of Emmanuel Levinas in terms of the importance of the ethical imperative of the face and the face-to-face relation in terms of structuring thought and in terms of grounding ethics. And so my final chapter, I allude to this phenomenological background in terms of this project. And again, this notion of the human face was really important for my own thinking about imperative of responsibility in clinical practice. And I thought it important to at least to give some kind of acknowledgement of the importance for me of this background philosophy in terms of the project. And again, that certainly one that can link up in terms of in the discipline of philosophical anthropology, in terms of the work of Michel Foucault and Kang Wilhelm, who you mentioned. Yeah, so, you know, there are parts in the book where there is a, I do mention phenomenology in the second chapter on moral intuitionism, where I conclude talking about the need for medical ethics to not simply to be about the ethics of strangers, and I argued that phenomenology provides the tools to reflect more deeply on the role of subjectivity in medicine and in medical ethics. So there was an allusion to phenomenology early in the book, but it's really only in the final chapter that this this thread, you know, that I make it more explicit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really, I think it's a good note to end our discussion of this book on. But before we end our discussion, Hillel, I just wanted to ask you, as is customary on the New Books Network, what are you working on now?
Okay. So, well, a number of things. But, you know, my project of thinking and writing about clinical reasoning is, I'm continuing with that. So I'm writing a number of chapters for books in edited volumes in philosophy of medicine on the subject of clinical reasoning and intuition and skill and virtuosity. And a lot of my present research revolves around the field of autism. But my key concern, which I bring to this field, is in terms of relating clinical expertise to theoretical reflection, and to integrate various forms of knowledge between history and philosophy of science, and biology and medicine, and ethics and philosophy. And yeah, so those on the one hand, continuing to write about issues of clinical reasoning and epistemology and ethics in medicine, and focusing particularly at the moment around the field of autism, and particularly around early diagnosis and intervention.
Cool. Well, that sounds really, really fascinating, and I think we all look forward to whatever gets written up on that work. And Hillel, I just wanted to take a chance to thank you again for giving us your time today. It's been a really fascinating interview. And, you know, I hope that for our listeners out there, you will go out and buy the book. If you need a primer in some of the philosophical concepts we've discussed, I think the book does do a good good work itself in sort of breaking these down. So I think it's the best way into philosophy sometimes, I find, is through personal motivation, through some kind of problem that you're trying to give voice to and understand. So I think that this book, while very, very academic, is super, super accessible in a way. And, you know, I encourage anybody who's listening to this to go out and get the book.